To focus a little bit on Judges, that's a book in the Bible. It's just after the first five books are called the Pentateuch or the Torah, ending in Deuteronomy, and then we have the story of Joshua, and then Judges follows straight on from Joshua. So it's the seventh part to the Old Testament. It's going to come on the screen in a minute. Preaching a little series that I've called Hidden Figures, and it's taken from the name of a film that was came out about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. Brilliant little film, and it's all about how there were some women of Afro-Caribbean, Afro-American background in the space race in NASA who were kind of unappreciated and assumed that their best role was to be clerical kind of its inputters and to fetch tea and make sure the men are particularly looked after because they're doing the important stuff. Some of you have seen it. It's a great film, really, really good film. And over the course of the film, spoiler alert, they discover that the stereotype, the kind of conviction that they had kind of worked with, that these women, who are they can't amount to much other than kind of put the oil in the cogs, actually are some of the most amazing, wise, insightful, mathematically able people in the whole of NASA. And that the Apollo kind of moon rockets wouldn't have happened without them. Great film. We're not doing a film night, much as that would be great. We could serialize it, couldn't we? We could have a four-parter, half an hour each. But I've called this series Hidden Figures because there are characters in the Bible, sometimes written in a few sentences, sometimes whole chapters, that for one reason or another, we kind of still see as hidden, or we kind of read over and we overlay perhaps a framework that belittles lessons and doesn't quite see what the scriptures would teach. And it's in this kind of thing, what I guess the bigger cultural question is, and particularly within the church, is what is the role of women? How do we see women in leadership, in ministry, in how does God raise up? And if you know anything else about this church, you kind of know that that's a given. That's not something that we're contesting. We're not kind of working through with an angst. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time doing this because I know that that question is out there. And actually, we all live with stereotypes. We all live with assumptions. We all live with, sometimes they're called glass ceilings, or sometimes the kind of the expectation. Who do we look to first and foremost about what maybe a leader or a suitable person? And I guess underlying all this, not only for women, is how often we have in our mind a concept of just the kind of person that God would raise up. Do you know what I mean? If you, sorry to get political, but if you are part of the Conservative Party, I guess there's a certain, whether it's known or unknown, there's a certain identikit picture of what a Tory leader might look like. I mean, they are good. They've had more women prime ministers than the Labour Party. Hooray, two of them now. Three of them, sorry, I forget the short one. Three of them, yeah, for a month. Three women prime ministers, much better than the Labour Party. But I guess I can't remember the figures, but so many of them would be from a public school and predominantly from Eton. There's a kind of like, that must be what leadership looks like. I guess from the Labour Party, there are other characteristics and understandings. But we do it all the time. But again and again, the scriptures kind of like to kind of blow those things out of the water. And I guess underlying all this is saying, we have this assumption about who God would choose. So King Saul was obviously the first king of Israel. That happens just after Judges. And he fit the bill of what a king would look like, didn't he? He was tall and he was strong, he was handsome, charismatic, kind of like all that, king material. But he was deeply flawed because, as the next scriptures talk about, when David, little David, seventh child, left out in the field minding the sheep, because, gosh, obviously you go for the oldest first, and no, Samuel discovers, the Lord says, no, I look at the heart. The heart matters. Again and again, it seems to be that the characters that would, in the world's eyes, be, yeah, they're the suitable ones, seem to fail. And the ones that God sees the potential, sees the heart, are raised up. Jacob, the son of Isaac, with his older brother Esau, was for much of his life a real deceiver. That's what his name means. He was deceptive and manipulative. Wouldn't be the choice for one of the patriarchs. So many of the disciples that Jesus picked were kind of like, really? These bunch from Galilee? They weren't from the upper echelons. Even though that's not saying that God doesn't use those. Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego in the book of Daniel were kind of like the best of the best of the intellectuals. But again, it was to do with the heart and the faith. So often, we have an assumption about what we think a person of God would look like because we look at the cover and we come at it with a kind of a framework. But what I think the scriptures are drawing from in this hidden figures series is to say, actually, all that is required is that we have faith, we trust in the Lord, we confess him as Lord, and are willing to go with him and do whatever he asks, whether it was Noah who picked up a hammer and saw and started to build an ark, or whether it was Abraham who heard God say, get up from this place, from this land, I will give you a new place. And he did, credited as righteousness. Again and again, that's what the Lord looks for. And I don't think it's gender exclusive. So Ruth, chapter 4. That was a long introduction, wasn't it? Chapter 4. I'm going to read it. Judges. Thank you. We're in Ruth, going to be in the morning. Judges, chapter 4. Sorry, Arnie, I gave you a little, like, oh my goodness. Judges is a complex, confusing book. It's not an easy read. It's not one of the ones you want to pick up and kind of read to the kids in all its brutality, because it's got tent pegs and fat people and kind of a lot of brutality. It's a really important book. So Deborah chapter 4. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, now that Ehud was dead. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Sisera, the commander of his army, was based in Harosheth, Hagoyim. Because he had 900 chariots fitted with iron and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. Now Deborah, a prophet, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went up to her to have their dispute decided. She sent for Barak, son of, that's not Obama, just to say, you know, but she did send for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops, to the Kishon River and give him into your hands. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. Certainly I'll go with you, said Deborah. But because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kedesh. There Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali, and 10,000 men went up under his command. Deborah also went up with him. Now Heber, the Kenite, had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent in the great tree in Zaanim. There's some great words in here, isn't there? not doing them all justice, near Kadesh. While they, when they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abiram, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera summoned from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River all his men and his 900 chariots fitted with iron. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you?" So Barak went down Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. And all Sisera's troops fell by the sword. Not a man was left. Sisera, meanwhile, fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Canaanite, because there was an alliance between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the family of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid." So he entered her tent, and she covered him with a blanket. "I'm thirsty," he said. "Please give me some water." She opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him up. "Stand in the doorway of the tent," he told her. "If someone comes by and asks you, 'Is anyone there?' say, 'No.'" But Jael, Heber's wife, picked up the tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. I know. Just then, Barak came by in pursuit of Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. "Come," she said, "I will show you the man you're looking for." So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with the tent peg through his temple, dead. On that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, before the Israelites. And the hand of the Israelites pressed harder and harder against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they destroyed him. And then chapter 5 is a song of Deborah and Barak, and we'll think about that in a moment. Now, that's going to raise a whole lot of questions like tent pegs, violence, swords, deceit. And I said to you that Judges is a complex and painful book. And let's just put aside the brutality of it and the unpleasant imagery that is kind of being drawn out, described. It's not very nice. And the violence, and like, where does that fit in the picture? Let's just pause that for the time being, not to ignore it, but let's just not be distracted by that at this moment. And recognize that this book is in the context of a story of Israel that is in a difficult, dark time. The Exodus is where Israel, God's people, have been in Egypt. They've been under increasingly brutal slavery, harder and harsher and harder and harsher, and they cry out, and for many, many years they cry out, "Lord, rescue us." And God raises up for them Moses from a wee little baby in the midst of genocide, infanticide going on. God rescues Moses. And then, even then, it takes 80 years for Moses to come back with the declaration, "Let my people go." And then there's a whole saga of weeks of kind of toing and froing. "Let my people go, no. Let my people go, no. Let my people go, okay, with conditions." Until finally, Moses and the Hebrews are able to leave Egypt, pursued and harassed, and God rescues them through the Red Sea and brings victory as Pharaoh and his violent soldiers are drowned across the other side of the Red Sea, and it seems to be going really well, yay! And then they kind of look back and say, "Well, we had lots of nice food in Egypt. Can't we go back? And you know what we knew, it wasn't very good, but we knew it. Let's, you know," and they started to doubt God, and God kind of judged them and said, "This generation, they're just faithless." So another 40 years, they wander in the wilderness, Sinai. And Moses dies, passes on the baton to Joshua, and Joshua leads through the book just before this, the people of God into the promised land, and it's occupied, and there's this kind of like, how do they take the land? Just before Judges starts, we're told that Joshua dies. And then enters this period in Israel's history between this kind of momentous rescue, where they're kind of in the promised land, but Judges says they're not really in the promised land. This toing and froing. That there's times when it goes well, and there's times that the other nations seem to crowd out again and crowd in and start to harangue and bring a threat to what God has promised. And there are two things going on in this story. There's one that for a time they recognize we're going to live for God. We're going to do it God's way. And then imperceptibly, year by year by year, they begin to kind of become more and more like the people around them. The distinctiveness, the way that God had called them to be and promised them to be, kind of just got watered down. And they started to do, there's this little refrain that comes up again and again, they started to do what they wanted to do in their own eyes. It doesn't matter. I'll just get on with life. I've lived life to the fullest. C'est la vie. And God says no. And in that, because they're doing what is right in their own eyes and not actually in God's eyes, he lets them understand the consequence of that. And they start to get oppressed by others, and they start to get these other nations start to have military victory and take away the land and start to oppress them, and they begin to start crying out, Lord, help us. They remember God, help us, help us, help us. And God raises up a deliverer, a judge, as it's called, a deliverer, a rescuer. Some of them are famous, like Gideon and Samson, and it should be that Deborah is famous. Because she is a deliverer. She's a rescuer. A judge. Maybe more like a phrase like a governor of the land. Deborah is an impressive woman of faith. The Old Testament has a whole bunch of them that are celebrated. Of Hannah and Esther and Miriam and Ruth, as we will be reading in the story, four chapters in the mornings. And Ruth is set in the time of the judges. It's in this kind of era where things go bad and then they cry out and God raises up a rescuer and they kind of live at peace for a period of time and then they forget and the judge dies and they sink back. And it's kind of like this cycle that gets worse and worse and worse. And the end of the book is very bleak. There's no king and they just do as they see fit. And into the midst of that, Deborah. There are great leaders in the Bible. Josiah, Josaphat, David. But there are many godless and bad and self-centered. And you know, the Bible is quite clear about judgments that it makes. About are they faithful to God or faithless? Deborah is among the good. There's not any place in the Bible in these two chapters where there's a question mark against a name. Kind of like, maybe. An ambiguity, not at all. There's no kind of sense in the story of which it we're told of the testimony, the character, unlike Gideon, who's kind of like, I can't do this, I'm too little, who am I? And compromises later on. And Samson, gosh, he's a complicated character. Deborah is portrayed really, really positively. It seems, well, it declares, not just seems, that her leading and her openness to the Spirit of God, her gifting and her leadership lead to 40 years of peace in the land. It's there in the end of chapter 5 and verse 31, at the end of her song. The song finishes and then there's this little kind of summary statement after her leading. So may all your enemies perish, Lord. May all who love you be like the sun, which rises in its strength. End of song. Then the land had peace for 40 years. Thanks to Deborah's leading. Deborah is courageous and valiant and faithful and strong. And doesn't conform to the stereotype of women should be just quiet and stay at home and look after the homestead and let the men get on with it. No, God raises her up in a time of convulsion and crisis when the very life of Israel is kind of in the mix because they've forgotten God and there's these other nations with other gods who are oppressing them. God raises up these deliverers, of which Deborah is a shining example. Calls her a prophet, we read that, a leader, and describes her as the mother of Israel. Amazing. Even in the midst of the challenging time. Chapter 2 sums it up like this, verse 18. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. This is chapter 2, verse 18 to 20. Chapter 2, verse 18 to 20. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods, serving and worshipping them, and they refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant I ordained for their ancestors and have not listened to me, and so forth. This pattern. And yet, Deborah. When we think of judge, we think of wigs and gowns and gavels. But actually, this is much more of a leader. God will raise some up who will catalyze the nation to stand true, to call people back to their love of God and recognizing he's called them out to serve him and to be a light in the darkness. As I said before, Deborah is the only judge in this book where nothing negative is said about them. And it ends with this song that Barak and Deborah sing, that ends with this song of triumph. So back just very briefly in a few words about her. Deborah is already judging, verse 4. Now Deborah, a prophet, interesting that, isn't it? A woman, prophet, the wife of Lapidoth. That's the only time we hear of Lapidoth. What great name, Lapidoth. Her husband, that she was leading Israel at that time. We never hear anything more about Lapidoth, but it just says that she was raised up, she was married, but she very clearly was the deliverer, the judge. She's not trained as a warrior. We're not given that others are, obviously Samson, couple of the others, but remember that that's not one of the criteria to be a warrior or powerful soldier. Gideon, far from it. But we know that she's a prophet and she's a magistrate. She's someone for whom the community would come when there were disputes, when there were issues of interpretation of the law, of when people fell out about a boundary or whose dog had bitten, whose, you know, this thing, or, you know, all those kind of things, that neighborly disputes and how to bring it. And she clearly is someone with effective wisdom and insight and discernment, and is also prophetic, the wisdom of God in her life. It's interesting the parallel that she has in this manner with Moses, who when they'd brought them out of Egypt and they were kind of in the wilderness, Moses was acting too as a judge, told in Exodus 18:13. People would come to him and saying, would you help us? We need to work out whose donkey this is and how this family dynamic works and, you know, all those kind of things. Judge Judy kind of thing, you know. He would listen and it got too much to him and they had to appoint others. But also there's this role of Samuel in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel. They would come to this leader to settle because they were demonstrating wise, godly impartiality. And she was already doing that. And Deborah, we're told, calls for Barak, who is one of these soldiers, but with a prophetic word, and says, Barak, the Lord will use you for victory. And he's kind of like, okay, and he's up for it, but he kind of says, he recognizes again, interestingly, unless you go with us, Deborah. It's almost like because she's such a celebrity, she's got such status and credibility, it's like, you come with us, because if we go on our own, you know, we won't have the prophet, we won't have this leader with us. And she's like, well, okay, we'll still have victory, but there's this kind of like, well, the true victory is going to be won by another woman. Which actually is really countercultural, isn't it? So often, the men want to be on the top spot on a podium. And Deborah says, okay, God is going to do this. Barak, you'll play a part, but you won't be the one to be celebrated. And we hear how Jael uses the tent peg, and it's a little bit unpleasant, more than a little bit. And then the story, the song comes in. It kind of reflects in certain ways another song that was sung by another woman, this time in Luke, and what we call the Magnificat, and of Mary's song on the announcing of the coming of the Messiah. It's a different song, but it carries these themes of God will bring justice and righteousness and hope in the face of oppression and hostility and violence. In many ways, Deborah acts as this forerunner, in some senses, of what God will do. In verse 7 of chapter 5, villagers in Israel would not fight. They held back until, this is the song, I, Deborah, arose, until I arose, a mother in Israel. In fact, so much of the song focuses on how God is using women in his purposes to bring about peace and stability. That this amazing deliverer, Deborah, prophet and judge, had this role in bringing back a sense of who God's people are, of calling them back to faithfulness and fidelity to God's promises, and promoting and lifting up Israel's national life across all the tribes. Coming back to God, a mother of Israel, physically and in a relationship to God. What an amazing woman. In a time where patriarchy clearly ruled the roost. As I said at the start, why is she important? Well, her story needs to speak. That so often these characters that God raises up can seem hidden and forgotten and glossed over quickly because we come at this with an assumption about what it looks like. And again, the scriptures kind of blow that assumption apart and say, if someone is for me, I can use them and I will raise them up because the heart is what matters. Trusting God in his word and serving him. It challenges those beliefs and those assumptions. Can a woman really do this? Is a woman allowed this? I mean, we've just heard in the news of all the challenges in Iran to take off a headscarf. I mean, imagine, I don't mean this in a bad way, but imagine how vibrant that population would be if half of it wasn't just so subjugated. Of allowing women to be women in the fullness of who God has made them to be. This curious mindset that our culture, even Western culture, carries for so long. I don't think women could run marathons until, I think the woman joined a marathon secretly in the 70s. They used to think that women would die if they ran 26 miles because they just can't, they're not strong enough. Couldn't go to space, couldn't go on trains because they'd go too fast and they wouldn't be able to bear. I mean, it's like we can allow a laugh, but is a woman allowed to? Well, Deborah could, and Deborah was, and God was with her and for her and behind this story and raised her up and inspired her and filled her with prophetic wisdom and called her to a key leadership at a critical time in the story of God's people and has a whole song dedicated to remembering what she has accomplished. She personifies and demonstrates grace and faith and wisdom and the vehicle through which God's peace is brought to troubled people. May he give us eyes and ears to hear. Let's pray.